Welcome to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm your volunteer reader, Neil Kelly. In this hour, we will be reading headlines from the Valley and the state and from USA Today. Our first local news article is titled, Here's Why the Biden Administration is Selling Border Wall Materials by Rafael Romero Ruiz, Arizona Republic. President-elect Donald Trump has called on President Joe Biden to halt the sale of unused border wall components originally intended for projects along the U.S.-Mexico border. The materials, including steel bollards, recently appeared for sale on GovPlanet, a government surplus auction marketplace. During a news conference Monday, Trump expressed frustration with the Biden administration over the auctions, which involved materials left in southern Arizona after Biden paused wall construction early in his presidency. I'm asking today, Joe Biden, to please stop selling the wall, Trump said, emphasizing the cost of the materials. He accused Biden of increasing expenses by selling the components just as his administration prepares to resume construction. It's very expensive, and now it's about to double the price of what it would have been 6 years ago, Trump said on Monday. And the Biden administration is trying to sell it for 5 cents on the dollar, knowing that we're getting ready. The auction listings have ignited debate online, with many questioning why the materials were sold when Trump campaigned to finish the wall. Representative Eli Crane, Republican of Arizona, told the Daily Wire, which first reported the auctions, that the Biden administration was purposely hamstringing the incoming Trump presidency. Former Arizona Governor Doug Ducey also criticized the sales, calling them a last-ditch effort to keep America's borders open by selling off materials the Trump administration will use to finish the wall. So why are the materials for the construction of more border fence being moved now? The answer is in the National Defense Authorization Act, a law passed by Congress in the 2024 fiscal year. Why are the materials being sold? Section 2890 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which introduced by Republican lawmakers in the House, requires the Department of Defense to develop a plan to use, transfer, or donate all covered materials purchased for border barrier construction between fiscal years 2017 and 2022. The law mandated that the Department of Defense submit a plan to use, transfer, or donate to states on the southern border of the United States all covered materials within 75 days of the National Defense Authorization Act's enactment and begin executing it 100 days later. The process continued until the date on which the Department of Defense is no longer incurring any costs to maintain, store, or protect the covered materials. This led to the eventual sale of a portion of these materials through GovPlanet, a government surplus marketplace. After fulfilling requests from U.S. Customs and Border Protection and eligible border states, transferring nearly 60% of the materials, the Department of Defense sold the remaining 40% through a competitive sales contract. The material currently being sold through GovPlanet online auctions no longer belongs to the U.S. government, and DOD has no legal authority to recall the material or stop further resale of material it no longer owns, the Department of Defense told the Arizona Republic in a written statement. Among those taking note of the auctions is Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who posted on X that the Texas Facilities Commission reviewed the panels listed for sale. According to Patrick, the commission concluded that the materials up for auction were mostly junk, with most panels covered in concrete and rust. He noted that a few usable panels were not worth the cost of shipping to Texas from Arizona. Still, Patrick emphasized the state's willingness to assist the incoming administration if some panels meet their standards. Make no mistake, Patrick wrote, Texas will make every effort, do whatever it takes, to assist the president, and we're going to secure this border once and for all for the people of America and Texas. Because the materials have been sold, the Department of Defense can no longer direct their final use. Any future decisions about the materials rest entirely with their new owners, whether private buyers or states willing to pay the cost of transportation and refurbishment. The next article is titled, Feds Fault Arizona Child Welfare Agency for Its Treatment of Parents, Kids with Disabilities, by Mary Jo Pitzel, Arizona Republic. A nearly five-year investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice concluded Arizona's Child Welfare Agency has repeatedly violated the civil rights of children and parents with disabilities. In releasing its findings Monday, the DOJ gave the Department of Child Safety 2 weeks to agree to work with it on solutions, such as revising policies and training employees on how to conform with the Americans with Disabilities Act. It also wants the agency to pay damages to parents and caregivers, although it did not state a figure. The offer to negotiate came with the threat of a possible lawsuit if DCS refuses, although the DOJ noted the agency cooperated with the probe. The investigation began in 2020, DCS officials said. In a statement, DCS said it committed to working compassionately with families and with disabilities and signaled it would cooperate on proposed improvements. Today, the department received findings of nearly 5-year-long investigation, the statement said. The department is reviewing these findings and will work with the DOJ to remedy any alleged violation of law. The report comes in the waning days of the Biden administration, and as DCS is still trying to climb out of a technological morass that has held up scores of cases involving family reunification and adoption for lack of complete documentation. Acting on complaints, the DOJ cited repeated violations of the ADA in cases involving parents and caregivers with hearing, vision, or intellectual disability issues. A theme throughout the 13-page report was the agency's failure to provide reasonable accommodations for people with disability issues. Discriminatory actions by child welfare agencies can have devastating and permanent consequences for parents and children. Kristen Clark, an assistant attorney general with the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, said in a statement announcing the investigative results. For example, DOJ heard from several parents who use American Sign Language. They said DCS failed to provide interpreters to help them communicate with their children during removals or on home visits, among other things. In one case, a hearing-impaired mother that didn't understand that DCS was attempting to take her children because there was no interpreter. The mother also could not read the document a caseworker gave her to explain the removal, although it was not clear in the report if she was also visually impaired. As a result, the mother had no idea where her children were being taken or why. This experience made it difficult for the mother and her children to understand what was happening and took a significant emotional toll on them, the report stated. The report also faulted DCS for not providing materials that would help parents and caregivers understand what was happening. Documents, such as a case plan in large print format, for example, could avoid a lot of confusion for visually impaired parents, the investigative report said. A portion of the investigation focused on what the DOJ said was the agency's reliance on stereotypes in dealing with clients with disabilities, instead of treating each case on its own merits. DCS staffers told investigators they heard colleagues referring to people with mental health disabilities crazy, loony, or psycho. In another case, a DCS supervisor described a parent as having mental retardation, an outdated and inaccurate description for a learning disability. The supervisor, the report stated, was aware that the term was inappropriate. The investigation highlighted the importance of providing reasonable accommodations for parents with disabilities, whether it be interpreters, assistive devices, or modified services that adapt to a parent's disability, all required by the ADA. This requires DCS to treat parents with disabilities as individuals and make decisions based on facts and objective information, the report said. One of the recommendations is to develop a training program in how to comply with the ADA. It should be required for DCS staff as well as the contractors who provide family services. The DOJ also recommends the agency designate a person to coordinate and comply with ADA requirements. DCS noted that in August 2023, it hired a staffer to oversee ADA compliance. It also advised anyone who feels their rights have been violated to contact the agency's ombudsman at ombudsman@acazdcs.gov or 602-364-0777 or 1-877-527-0765. The next article is titled, Arizona Will Be a Housing Hotspot in 2025. Here Are Some of the Best Cities to Live In, by Laura Daniela Sepulveda, Shelby Slade, and Rhea Lee, Arizona Republic. Metro Phoenix has long been a housing hotspot, and it looks like that will continue into 2025. The National Association of Realtors released the top 10 housing hotspots for 2025 on Thursday, and the Phoenix, Mesa, and Chandler areas made the list. It's no surprise either, as a dip in mortgage rates to about 6.08% gave Metro Phoenix's housing market a bit of a lift in late September and October. Home prices, sales, and supply all climbed during that time frame, according to the Arizona Regional Multiple Listing Service. If you are considering a move across town or to the Grand Canyon State, here are some Metro Phoenix cities that were ranked top places to live in 2024. Chandler, ranked among the best places for families. Chandler was ranked as one of the best places in the United States to live for families in a study from Forbes. Chandler came in at number 37 on the media organization's third annual list. Gilbert, named the best Arizona city to raise a family in. Gilbert was ranked 6th out of more than 180 cities to raise a family in, according to a study from WalletHub, which analyzed 45 metrics like housing costs, quality of schools, and healthcare systems and opportunities for family fun. Metro Phoenix City, named best for renters. A recent study from Forbes named two Arizona cities as best for renters because of the cost and availability of rentals. While Tucson ranked 9th overall, Gilbert ranked 13 of the 95 cities Forbes analyzed for its study, according to 72.55 out of 100. Scottsdale, named the happiest city in Arizona. Scottsdale was named the 10th happiest city in the U.S. in a WalletHub ranking that examined 182 cities based on 29 key indicators of happiness, including depression rates, income growth rates, and average leisure time per day. Queen Creek ranked best small city in Arizona. Queen Creek was the highest ranked small Arizona city on the list. The small city was ranked as the 72nd most affordable small city in the U.S., and it was the 80th highest ranked small city in terms of economic health. Phoenix ranked high for retirees. The greater Phoenix area was ranked the 52nd best place to retire by U.S. News & World Report. Phoenix's thriving job market, nice winter weather, and low cost of living compared with coastal cities were all reasons for the ranking. Scottsdale, also a great city for retirement. WalletHub analyzed 182 cities earlier this year and found that Scottsdale is the 6th best place to retire in the U.S., especially due to the high quality of life it offers. The top 10 housing spots for 2025: Boston, Cambridge, Newton, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. Charlotte, Conrad, Gastonia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. Grand Rapids, Kentwood, Michigan. Greenville, Anderson, South Carolina. Hartford, East Hartford, Middleton, Connecticut. Indianapolis, Carmel, Anderson, Indiana. Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas. Knoxville, Tennessee. Phoenix, Mesa, Chandler, Arizona, and San Antonio, New Braunfels, Texas. The next article is titled, "Human-Caused Soap Fire Burns Over 600 Acres Close to Black Canyon City," by Ray Covarrubias, Jr., Arizona Republic. Federal authorities said the human-started soap fire burned over 600 acres of mountain terrain near Black Canyon City on Monday evening. The fire, first spotted on Sunday afternoon, burned about 3 miles northwest of the Interstate 17 adjacent community, about an hour north of Phoenix, according to the Bureau of Land Management, Arizona Fire Management, on the social media platform X. By Tuesday afternoon, the fire was at about 630 acres of steep terrain on both BLM and state land. BLM said the fire was human-caused and remained under investigation but did not share specific details. The fire was 0% contained, with almost 30 people helping to put out the blaze as of Tuesday afternoon. The fire is in a rugged area within remote area with very limited access, said Chris Wunderly, BLM spokesperson. Much of Arizona remained critically dry, according to Wunderly, who warned of extra precautions for those working, doing recreational activities, or traveling across the state. Arizonans witnessed the fire from all angles since it starts at the end of the weekend. One user shared an image the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management posted on X of the billowing smoke in the background of dry desert hills. Another showed the dull illumination of the fire overnight, with the home seen near the flames. The next article is titled, These Three Charming Arizona Streets Are Top for Shoppers, by Sean Raimundo and Ginny Sandoval, Arizona Republic. Three of Arizona's popular streets cracked this year's list of people's favorite places to get their Christmas shopping done. The website present.com, which shares tips and ideas for gifts to give on any occasion, surveyed 3,000 people to find America's favorite main streets to shop for Christmas presents. The respondents helped identify the top 150 streets to visit if you're looking to find the right gift for your loved ones. Those streets represent historic areas that have maintained their charm over the years and are beloved by locals. They also serve as hidden gems for those who'd prefer to support their local economy rather than just order presents online. Here are the three main streets in Arizona that ranked among the top Christmas shopping destinations. Main Street in Bisbee. Main Street along Bisbee's historic downtown is home to iconic shops and restaurants, so it's no wonder why it was included in the list at number 68. The stretch of road is revered for its 19th century architecture that harkens back to the area's mining days. It gives shoppers plenty of options from art galleries to antique and jewelry shops. Whiskey Row in Prescott. Downtown Prescott's Whiskey Row along Montezuma Street came in at number 85. Named for its abundance of saloons in one area, Whiskey Row contains some of the town's oldest historic spots that used to attract cowboys, settlers, gamblers, and even outlaws. Nowadays, it's much more family-friendly with candy shops and art galleries, but there's still a lively music scene and, of course, saloons. Main Street in Jerome. Jerome's Main Street was ranked number 130 on the list. The old mountain mining community has maintained its small-town charm and is known for its plethora of antique and unique retail shops, clothing, and pottery stores and art galleries. Here's what makes these Christmas shopping spots unique. According to Present.com, the survey also focused on specific things respondents value and enjoy during their holiday shopping experience, and why small-town main streets are special places to shop during the holidays. The survey found that 36% of respondents value unique and locally made gifts, while 34% value festive decor and atmosphere. Others said customer service, historic charm, and accessibility were also important. In the types of stores people enjoy, 30% ranked boutique clothing and fashion stores the highest, while 22% were for vintage and antique shops, 20% for unique offerings, 16% for bookstores and specialty shops, and 12% for local food and wine shops. When it came to specific elements of holiday shopping, the survey found that 46% enjoyed the light displays and festive decorations, 22% chose winter markets and seasonal ops, and the rest were fond of warm and relaxing spaces, horse-drawn carriages, and street performances. When asked to describe the ideal main street for holiday shopping in one word, 66% said festive, 10% said cozy, another 10% said quaint, 8% said vibrant, and 6% said elegant, according to the survey. The top 10 main streets in the U.S. for Christmas shopping were 1. Main Street, Aurora, New York. 2. Main Street, Cooperstown, New York. 3. Main Street, New Hope, Pennsylvania. 4. Main Street, Mystic, Connecticut. 5. Ocean Avenue, Carmel by the Sea, California. 6. Genesee Street, Skaneateles, New York. 7. Broad Street, Nevada City, California. 8. Main Street, Lake Placid, New York. 9. Main Street, Tarrytown, New York. 10. Park Avenue, Winter Park, Florida. The next article is titled, Gilbert Council Member Shares False Rumor in Attempt to Discredit Republic Goons Reporter, Elena Santa Cruz and Maritza Dominguez, Arizona Republic. A Gilbert Council member tried to discredit an Arizona Republic investigation by falsely saying a reporter had a personal history with Gilbert Police Department. 2 weeks after Republic reporter Robert Anglin said Councilmember Chuck Bongiovanni and Gilbert Police Chief Michael Solberg inquiries about the department's handling of Gilbert Goon's beatings, Bongiovanni told a community member Anglin had a grudge against Gilbert police. "Do you know why Robert has a hard-on for them?" Bongiovanni said in an October 23rd text by the Arizona Republic. "There's also a little personal issue, if you know what I mean." Bongiovanni did not describe the little personal issue in his texts. But a different Robert Anglin was arrested in 2013 on suspicion of harassing his ex-girlfriend, according to Gilbert police records. That Robert Anglin now lives out of state and has a different birth date, physical description, and middle name from the Republic reporter with the same first and last names. Solberg and town officials would not answer direct questions from Bongiovanni's texts. They would not say if they knew how Bongiovanni came to believe Robert Anglin, the Republic reporter, had a personal issue with Gilbert police, or whether other town officials received false information about the reporter from Solberg or another police official. Bongiovanni did not respond to multiple interview requests. Before a December 3rd town council meeting, he said, "There's no story there." A town spokesperson answered for Bongiovanni, saying town officials would not comment on unsubstantiated claims and rumors, even though Bongiovanni sent the texts and made the insinuation. Greg Burton, the Arizona Republic executive editor, said, "Reporters Robert Anglin and Elena Santa Cruz have worked around the clock for more than a year to uncover what police in Gilbert could or would not widespread and deadly teen violence. A smear and whisper campaign attacking the messenger is more evidence of a city prioritizing self-interest over public service." The Republic, in December 2023, first tied the fatal beating of 16-year-old Preston Lord to the Goons, a gang of teenagers whose attacks on other teens went unchecked by police for more than a year. Gilbert was the nexus for the beatings, but police failed to connect the attacks. Authorities reopened multiple shelved cases and initiated new investigations into gang attacks and, in January, made the first arrests connected to Goons beatings in Gilbert, Mesa, and Pinal County. Gilbert police have withheld records and provided conflicting arrest data about Goons' assaults. Solberg declined to answer specific questions about the Goons and only agreed to an October interview about teen violence on the condition that past cases or timelines not be discussed. The Republic filed a public records request for all police records involving any Robert Anglin to uncover how Bongiovanni falsely concluded reporter Michael Robert reported Robert Anglin had a personal issue with Gilbert police. "There was one arrest associated with a Robert Anglin from 2013, a police spokesperson said, but officials were unsure if it was the reporter. With the absence of Arizona Republic reporter Robert Anglin's personal identifying information, it is unknown if the Robert Anglin in the report is the same Robert Anglin with your organization," spokesperson Brenda Carrasco said in an email. The police report details a domestic violence case involving a Robert Anglin who was 52 years old at the time. He worked in healthcare. Police officials failed to explain why the department couldn't differentiate between two people with the same first and last names, or whether someone had run the same Robert Anglin through department computers. The arrest detail were not released to the Republic, police officials said. Solberg avoided answering if he shared the information with Bongiovanni or others, and told reporters they had to wait for police records related to the matter. On October 28th, he would not say whether he believed Republic reporter Robert Anglin had domestic violence in his past. "I don't know if you do or not," he said in an interview. "We will be giving you those documents tomorrow. Just leave it at that." Solberg indicated he would be willing to discuss the situation after the records were released, but interview requests have since been denied. Some town council members said they had not heard the false claim that reporter Robert Anglin had a personal history with Gilbert police. Others wouldn't talk. Jim Torgerson said he definitely would have remembered if he heard the reporter had been accused of domestic violence. Jung Kaprowski said she could not discuss the Robert Anglin arrest because the matter was under review. Town officials said Kaprowski was referring to the internal review of police records the Republic requested, but that review was completed 2 days before the council member's statement. Mayor Brigitte Peterson directed questions to her office. A spokesperson said the mayor had no recollection of any conversations with anyone, including members of the Gilbert Police Department or town council, in which she was told Gilbert police had arrested the reporter. Mayer recommends you connect with the member of the council whom you state made those remarks for clarification, Kirsten Morgan said in an email. The remaining council members and town manager did not address the issue. This information was never shared or disseminated to the public, town spokesperson Candace Kwan said in an email. Both police and town officials redirected the conversation to their dedication to tackling teen violence. The Gilbert Police Department and the town remain committed to working with our media partners to address matters of public safety within our community and remain steadfast in combating teen violence while supporting and protecting our youth, Kwan said. Our next article is titled, Red Light Runner Leads to Fatal Phoenix Crash Near Southbound I-17 and Indian School Road, by Skylar Hasey, Arizona Republic. Phoenix police are investigating a fatal crash that left one man dead and another critically injured Friday night. According to police investigations, 30-year-old Daniel Jacobs was driving an Infiniti G37 sedan eastbound on Indian School Road around 10:30 p.m., when he ran a red light at the Interstate 17 southbound access road. His car collided with a Toyota Tacoma truck driven by a 29-year-old man who had the green light. The collision caused Jacob's vehicle to veer off the road, crash through a chain-link fence, and drop approximately 30 feet onto the I-17 freeway. A southbound GMC Sierra then struck Jacob's car, which came to rest against the freeway's median barrier. Emergency responders extricated Jacobs from the wreckage and took him to a hospital, where he died the next day due to his injuries. The driver of the Toyota Tacoma, whose vehicle rolled and landed in eastbound traffic lanes, was also extricated and taken to a hospital in critical condition. The driver of the GMC Sierra, a 39-year-old man, was not seriously injured. The next local news article is titled, One Person Dead in Phoenix Police Shooting in North Phoenix, Thunderbird Road Closed, by Jose R. Gonzalez, Arizona Republic. A person was killed Wednesday in a police shooting in North Phoenix on Wednesday, according to authorities. The shooting happened at a restaurant in the area of Thunderbird Road and 28th Avenue, according to Phoenix police officials. The area is a few blocks west of Interstate 17. Thunderbird Road is expected to be closed for an extended part of the day, police said. The suspect shot at police, spokesperson Sergeant Brian Bauer said. Bauer declined to describe the shooting as an exchange of shots. This is the 14th time police have been shot at in the line of duty incident this year, police said. There were no injuries to officers, according to police. This is at least the 20th person Phoenix police have shot this year, according to information previously shared by the department. This is at least the 15th fatal shooting by Phoenix police this year, according to data compiled by the Republic. The next article is titled, You Shot Me. Body cam shows police shooting man in North Phoenix mobile home, by Jose R. Gonzalez, Arizona Republic. Police released body camera video and the dispatcher call from the night of December 2nd when a knife-wielding man was shot by an officer at a North Phoenix home following a reported domestic disturbance. The body camera footage and the dispatcher call are part of what police, Phoenix police, calls a critical incident briefing video uploaded Monday onto YouTube. The man police shot was previously identified as 55-year-old Abraham Hermosillo. Police said Hermosillo was charged on suspicion of multiple felonies, which court records show included aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, disorderly conduct with a weapon, and use of a dangerous drug. Hermosillo was indicted on all three charges and has a trial set for April 17th. Police said officers were responding to a mobile home in the area of 20th Street and Union Hills Drive. The audio in the video plays as a woman tells a 911 operator that her son is still at home upon her taking a knife away from him following all day arguing between the two, according to police. The woman is heard telling the dispatcher that she thinks her son is on something and that he took her spatula before asking for officers to approach slowly. A records check by responding officers found the man had an outstanding warrant for his arrest, police said. The body camera video by the officer who shot Hermosillo shows officers being let into the home by a woman and another man. The woman tells officers that Hermosillo has two knives and is in a bedroom, police said. Officers ordered the woman to step outside, but she instead walked toward the living room, the video shows. A zoom in by police of the body camera footage shows Hermosillo holding an object in his hand. The video also shows he has an object in his right hand, which he is seen lifting in the direction of the officer. The officer, whose body camera footage is first featured in the video, has his hands visible, showing him pointing a gun at Hermosillo. He is heard shouting, "What are you doing? Let me see your hands right now. Let me see your hands right now." A glimpse of the man can be seen at what police said is a bedroom doorway, while he is heard shouting, "They're arguing. I'm trying to break them up." The body camera video shows officers ordering Hermosillo to show his hands before he comes out of the room with a knife in one hand and an object in the other. Another officer is heard telling Hermosillo he is under arrest, while the man counters that he is not under arrest. Officers near the front entrance of the home are heard ordering Hermosillo to drop the knife as video shows him walking toward what is later revealed to be a living room and back to the bedroom. As seen in the video, an officer uses his handgun to shoot Hermosillo, who is then seen running into a bedroom and shouting. After the shooting, officers on the video can be heard repeatedly telling Hermosillo to get on the ground, with one saying he has a big knife before the man, who is at the doorway, is seen throwing an object onto the kitchen floor. The mother then walks out of the home after being told to do so by an officer, as seen in a backup officer's body camera video. Hermosillo is seen in the same backup officer's body camera video as he crouches and shouts at one point, saying, "You shot me," as he complains that the officers did not follow procedure. Officers are seen approaching the wounded man through an adjacent living room space as one tells him, "Lay down so we can get you help." Another officer shocks Hermosillo with a taser as he lies in a puddle of his own blood. As officers handcuff him, he is heard saying, "I'm thirsty. Can I get some water? I want some water, please." Hermosillo was taken to a hospital and treated for a gunshot wound to his arm before he was released and then questioned by detectives and eventually booked into jail, police said. There were no others injured during the call response, according to police. The knife Hermosillo is suspected of holding was found in a bedroom, along with a pepper spray bottle on the kitchen floor, police added. Police disclosed that the officer who shot the man is assigned to the Black Mountain Precinct and is a 23-year member of the force. Conclusions about whether the actions of the officers are consistent with department policy and the law will not be made until all facts are known and the investigation is complete, police said it in a statement, adding the shooting will be investigated internally and criminally. The Maricopa County Attorney's Office will then review the criminal investigation, police said. This was at least the 19th person Phoenix police have shot this year, according to information previously shared by the department. You are listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Neil Kelly, and we'll continue. The next article is titled, "Car Crash Involving Apache Junction Police Officer Leaves Man Dead," by Jose R. Gonzalez, Arizona Republic. A crash involving an Apache Junction police officer Tuesday afternoon has led to a death. An officer responding to a call around 4:20 p.m., crashed with another vehicle at the intersection of Apache Trail and Valley Drive, according to Apache Junction Police. The officer was hospitalized, as was the other driver who died of injuries sustained in the crash, police said. "Our thoughts are with the families of those involved during this difficult time," police said in a statement. The other driver's identity was withheld until next of kin is notified, police said. A crash investigation was opened and was taken over by the Arizona Department of Public Safety. The next article is titled, "Maricopa County Attorney's Office, Tempe Couple Indicted on Abuse Charges Involving Two Children," by Kunle Falaye, Arizona Republic. A Tempe couple has been indicted on charges involving two children, according to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Brittany Furch, 34, faces two counts of child abuse, a Class 2 felony, and a dangerous crime against children. Demetrius Jones, 32, faces four counts of child abuse, a Class 4 felony, the county attorney's office said. On November 25th, Tempe police were called to a hospital where two children, ages 4 and 12, were being treated for serious injuries, according to county attorney's office. Those injuries included bruising, swelling, and signs of non-fatal drowning, according to the county attorney's office. Furch and Jones committed the offenses between November 24th and 25th, according to the indictment. The children had been immersed in a bathtub, injured with a spatula and a purse strap, the indictment detailed. They had external head bruises and injuries to the mouth. Furch remained in custody on a secured appearance bond of $100,000, while Jones' bond was set at $75,000, secured, the county attorney's office said. The next article is titled, New Seatbelt Rules Are Coming. Here's What Arizonans Need to Know, by Greta Kroos and Shelby Slade, Arizona Republic. Arizonans need to buckle up when in the car, and we'll be hearing more dings when seatbelts aren't latched. In 2 years, vehicle manufacturers will be required to install seatbelt warning systems on all car seats rather than just the driver. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration finalized a rule on Monday that will require seatbelt use warnings for rear and passenger seats and enhanced warnings for driver's seats. The rule amends Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard No. 208, which went into effect in 1968. Though vehicle manufacturers were installing seatbelts before then, this was when the federal government mandated that seatbelts be installed for driver's seats. While seatbelts use has improved for decades, there's still more we can do to make sure everyone buckles up. These new requirements will help to increase seatbelt use, especially for rear seat passengers, by enhancing reminders for vehicle occupants to buckle up, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration Chief Counsel Adam Raviv said in a news release. Here's what Arizonans need to know about the changes to seatbelt rules. When will the new rule be implemented? Front seatbelt warning systems must comply with the new rule by September 1, 2026, and rear seatbelt warning systems must comply by September 1, 2027, the rule states. Vehicle manufacturers are welcome to comply with the new rule ahead of these dates. What vehicles does the new rule apply to? The rule applies to passenger cars, trucks, most buses, not school buses, and multipurpose passenger vehicles with a weight rating of 10,000 pounds or less. What will rear seat belt warnings sound look like? Under the new rule, vehicles must display visual and audio warnings upon startup to inform the driver of the status of rear seat belts. The visual warning must last at least 60 seconds, and the audio warning must last at least 30 seconds. If the vehicle can determine rear seats are not occupied, no warnings are required. Why is this seatbelt rule being implemented? The rule aims to prevent vehicle-related injuries and deaths. On average, there are 822 fatalities and more than 11,000 injuries due to backseat occupants not wearing seatbelts each year, according to the rule. Implementation of the rule will prevent more than 500 injuries and 50 deaths each year, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said in a news release. What is Arizona's seatbelt law? Arizona law requires seatbelts be worn by those in front seat of a car, according to the Phoenix Fire Department. Drivers must make sure that all passengers under 16 wear their seatbelts. A 16-year-old in the front seat can be cited for not wearing a seatbelt. Passenger seatbelt warnings will be required. Though most vehicles manufactured in 2022 or later have passenger seatbelt warnings, the new rule requires them. What enhancements will be required of driver seatbelt warnings? Though visual and audio seatbelt warnings have long been used for driver seats, the new rule requires them to be longer. A visual warning will be required when a vehicle's ignition switch is on, the seat is occupied, and the seatbelt is not in use. The audio warning will be in two phases. The first must last at least 30 seconds. The second phase must activate when the seat is occupied. The seatbelt is not in use, and the vehicle speed is at least 6.2 miles per hour, the rule states. The next article is titled, White Gates Home Denied Historic Overlay, Salvage Process to Begin on Phoenix Property, by Karina Vanek, Arizona Republic. A plan that will salvage artistic pieces of a northeast Phoenix home can move forward after a marathon 4-hour public hearing that pitted property ownership against historic preservation. The Phoenix Historic Preservation Commission voted not to initiate a historic overlay on the home during its tense meeting Monday night that exposed the rift between the commission and the city council that appointed it. The home, known as White Gates, was designed by Al Beadle, a prominent Phoenix architect known for his mid-century modern designs that take inspiration from their desert setting. Yasser Al-Shire bought the house in early 2024 with the intention of demolishing it and building a new home on the site. However, the plan sparked a major public outcry from people who said the home's history, cultural value, and architectural value should save the home from demolition. The home is located near Camelback Mountain, east of 44th Street and north of Camelback Road. Commission members voted against initiating the overlay, but lamented that they felt that a plan that was proposed to save the iconic pieces of the home, the white front panels, the back steel trellises, and the circular planters, subverted the city's historic preservation process. The deal that was struck hinged on the overlay not being initiated. Ben Graff, an attorney representing El Shire in the case, said the deal was off the table if the overlay was initiated, because El Shire would then devote his resources to fighting it. I feel manipulated by this process, and frankly I don't appreciate the end run around the historic preservation process in the city, Commission Chair Daniel Garcia said. I believe we have our hands tied. Normally, when demolition permits are issued in Phoenix for buildings older than 50 years, a 30-day hold is triggered to allow the Historic Preservation Commission to evaluate whether the property should receive a historic preservation overlay, enabling temporary protection. After the demolition permit is issued, a property owner has 60 days to demolish it. However, in this case, the plan creates a 10-month hold that will allow the owner time to remove the recognizable white panels and other pieces to be salvaged and relocated. The plan also calls for $50,000 to be put into an escrow account to pay for future placement of the panels. The house has been vacant for at least a decade, Graff said during the meeting, and damage to glass walls and other parts of the building has left it open to the elements and heavily damaged by water. Some pieces of the home that would contribute to its historic value, including a carport that mirrored the design of the panels and some of the customized eastern and western walls, have been demolished or replaced with non-original pieces over the years. Members of the public, including those involved in the negotiation of the salvage plan, also expressed frustration with it and instead sought more protection to keep the home intact and in place. Many said they would reluctantly support the salvage but felt like the plan kneecapped the city's historic preservation processes. During the meeting, Lauren Bailey, the co-founder and CEO of Upward Projects, the restaurant group that created Postino, Federal Pizza, and other concepts, asked the commission to instead initiate the process for landmark status, which could require demolition to be delayed 3 years. Bailey asked the commission to do whatever it could to motivate El Shire to sell the property to someone who would preserve it. Before the negotiation process, Bailey said, El Shire offered her the panels to display, and she said no. I don't want a reminder of this wrecked house on my property, she said, adding that Phoenix has so few historic buildings already. It is worth the trouble to restore them, she said. Allison King, an associate professor and creator of Modern Phoenix, said she hoped white gates could be restored in place because a significant aspect of the home's appeal comes from its proximity to Camelback Mountain. She said she would support the salvage plan but called the destruction of the home a crisis for people who are sensitive to the healing and unifying capacity of arts. Ashley Harder, a developer who specializes in adaptive reuse projects, said while she was willing to support the salvage plan, salvage is not preservation. She called the salvage plan generous, but said it is not the purpose of the commission to review such plans, and instead asked that they opt to initiate landmark status. Jerry Beadle Murray, the daughter of the home's architect, said her dream would have to be to have the house designated as historic, but if the home could not be saved, she supported the compromise to preserve the artistic parts of the home. Beadle Murray addressed the commission wearing a shirt with a white ellipse pattern, mirroring the design of the recognizable white gate panels. Graff, the attorney representing El Shire, said El Shire had no interest in selling the property and wants to redevelop the site for his personal home. The commission voted 6-2 against initiating the temporary protection, with many commissioners expressing frustration that the plan did not follow the city's process. Commissioner Christina Noble said she felt like the commission was held hostage in the decision. Commissioner Dan Clock said the group already has very little enforcement power and said rejecting a plan that was negotiated could discourage future developers from engaging in any negotiation at all. Our only ability is negotiation, he said. If we undermine our own ability, it shoots ourselves in the foot. Clock and other commission members also pointed to other examples in the city where the commission has initiated the overlay against the wishes of the property owner, and the city council has then reversed the commission's effort. We've been here and tried again and again and again, and unfortunately, our council has continued to reject these requests, Clock said. The case of the Milam Textile Services building at 7th Avenue and Van Buren Street was one such example, when the commission recommended a historic overlay be placed on the site, against the will of the owners. Both the Planning Commission and Phoenix City Council voted against the overlay, clearing the way for building to be demolished. Commissioner Francesca Miller said she was saddened that the house was sold to someone with no interest in preservation, but was afraid if the commission did something other than approve the plan for the compromise, things would not turn out any better down the road. Sometimes the compromise is better than the demise, she said. In a statement, El Shaier said he was very pleased with the decision against the overlay. Out of respect for the community and at Councilmember Robinson's request, I voluntarily withdrew the initial demolition permit and delayed my plans to allow time for thoughtful discussions, El Shaier wrote in part. Through this process, the stakeholders presented a proposal I accepted. I was proud to present this compromise to the HP Commission this evening. I am also pleased the Beadle family supports this compromise, ensuring Al Beadle's legacy will continue to be celebrated in a meaningful and lasting way. However, the group advocating for preserving the home said the move reflected the unwillingness of the council to support the commission's decisions, not an assessment of the value of keeping the home intact. This case has highlighted the massive disconnect that exists between the Historic Preservation Commission and Phoenix's City Council, which has routinely denied the Commission's recommendations, Bailey said in an email on Tuesday. Now that this dysfunction has been exposed, my concern is that the deal Yasser Al-Shaier and Ben Graff have creatively brokered has set a dangerous precedent, allowing individuals and developers to effectively buy their way into demolishing the few remaining historic structures in Arizona, as long as they write a check and use the threat of demolition as leverage. This has made an already fractured process even worse, she added. The holding period to salvage the pieces of the home will last 320 days, or a little over 10 months, and will begin when the demolition permit is filed. We move on to USA Today. And the first article has the title, Zap It and Put It in a Bag, Inside the Military's Response to Drones Flying Over Bases, by Tom Vandenbroek and Sabel Mays Osterman, USA Today. Washington. The more than 5,000 reported drone sightings in recent weeks that have captivated and freaked out East Coast residents have been commonplace at sensitive U.S. military sites across the country, according to defense officials. There have been hundreds, perhaps thousands, of drone incursions at remote military installations, drawing little public attention. But they have disrupted sensitive operations, according to the Pentagon officials who spoke to USA Today, on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive military operations. A critical concern, foreign adversaries have identified a seam in the U.S. response to drone surveillance. U.S. military forces have the authority to take down drones, blasting them from the sky or severing their navigational links by radio jamming if the aircraft penetrates airspace over a base and poses a threat. Yet once outside that airspace, the drone becomes the responsibility of local law enforcement. In the vast, sparsely populated areas that are home to many military installations, the response is often too little and way too late, according to a defense official who has dealt with incursions. Another senior official said the Pentagon had been too passive in the face of the growing threat. This official offered a solution to an unidentified drone: zap it, put it in a bag, and exploit it for clues about its origin and intent. The Air Force, in fact, has done so. Drones have been taken down by Air Force personnel in recent years, said Anne Stefanik, an Air Force spokeswoman. She declined to provide further details, citing operational security concerns. Yet legal concerns and worries about debris causing damage or death on the ground have hamstrung the response. The military has a robust air defense system in place to defend against the potential of hijacked airlines, but the same can't be said for drones, said David Deptula, the dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies and a retired three-star Air Force general. Just no one thought about airliners causing harm before 9/11. We need to recognize the negative potential and the lethal potential of drones that we're seeing around the world in their use for military and hostile purposes, he said. In a joint statement Monday, the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security, the FBI, and the Federal Aviation Administration urged Congress to enact legislation that would extend and expand existing counter-drone authorities to identify and mitigate any threat that may emerge. The statement also downplayed the current drone hysteria, noting that most of the reports have turned out to be lawful commercial, hobbyist, and law enforcement drones, manned aircraft, and helicopters. Even STARS have been mistakenly reported as drones. But lawmakers are also paying attention. Members of the House Intelligence Committee received a closed-door briefing on the issue on Tuesday. Spy drones could collect sensitive information on U.S. military activities that could tip off adversaries to future deployments, one military official said. For example, aerial surveillance could show the movement of ammunition from arsenals to port as the Pentagon prepared for war. A drone could also provide real-time video of the rapid response of Special Forces soldiers out of Fort Liberty. In recent years, drones swarmed the site of a planned military exercise, forcing U.S. Northern Command, responsible for protecting the homeland from attack, to delay the exercise, the officials said. A hostile drone flying within around 200 feet of a military base could have a much higher resolution look at military assets than satellites or other airborne technologies, Deptula said. F-22 fighters, the most sophisticated warplanes in the Air Force fleet, may have been the target of mysterious waves of drones that soared over Langley Air Force Base in Virginia last year, Deptula said. If you get up real close to those aircraft, you can detect and observe shapes and construction techniques that you might not be able to detect from an overhead satellite, he said. Other sensitive points that hostile drones could surveil include America's electric grid and telecommunications sites. An adversary could try to find the linchpins and nodes upon how the power distribution system is aligned and distributed, he said. Where are the drone sightings happening? The joint statement issued Monday acknowledged drones had penetrated restricted airspace over military installations in New Jersey and elsewhere. In New Jersey, some were spotted over the Picatinny Arsenal, an active weapons research and development facility owned by the Army that sprawls across nearly 6,000 acres. Other sites of drone incursions include White Sands Missile Range, according to the military official, the Army's only land range for testing long-distance missiles, explosives, and military and artillery. The tract, 100 miles long and 40 miles wide, straddles New Mexico and Texas. Its airspace is controlled by the Pentagon, one of only two sites in the country where the FAA does not have jurisdiction. The White House is the only other one. Drones have surveilled Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, the official said, and remotely operated vessels have also been suspected of surveilling U.S. Navy facilities. What can be done about the drones? If a drone was deemed a threat, officials have several active and passive measures they could take to respond, like using the military's own drones to take it down, redirecting it, or interfering with its navigational signal, Air Force Major General Pat Ryder, the Pentagon press secretary, told reporters. Ryder said at a Tuesday news conference that Picatinny Arsenal and Naval Weapons Station Earl, another New Jersey base where drones were spotted, have received extra drone detection and defense equipment, including drone busters, a handheld instrument that jams drone signals. Some of those methods are covered in a new strategy to counter drones signed by Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin earlier this month. Although the full plan is classified, it aims to improve the military's ability to detect and track drones and delegate responsibility for taking out a threat, according to the Pentagon. The military doesn't have the same authority to track and take down drones over bases within U.S. borders as it does overseas or in combat zones. We don't collect intelligence on American citizens, Ryder said. Drones have already taken lives at U.S. military bases abroad. In January, a drone attacked Tower 22, a U.S. base in Jordan, killing three American soldiers, wounding more than 40. A one-way drone, which is programmed with a target and doesn't need direction in midair, was used in the attack. The current drone mania also echoes the Chinese spy balloon incident that riveted the country in 2023. The Pentagon monitored the balloon, bristling with spyware, as it passed over sensitive military sites on its transit across the country. An F-22 shot the balloon down off the South Carolina shore days after it first crossed into Alaska. Our next article is titled, Charles Barkley Not Sure About Making Move to ESPN. I Haven't Decided Yet, by Jordan Mendoza, USA Today. Even though Inside the NBA will be moving to ESPN next season, it could be without one key star. Through a partnership between ESPN and Warner Brothers Discovery, the popular NBA show will run on ESPN, ensuring the show would remain on airwaves after TNT missed out on the league's new 11-year, $76 billion TV deal with ABC/ESPN, NBC, and Amazon. While basketball fans were excited to see the cast of Ernie Johnson, Charles Barkley, Kenny Smith, and Shaquille O'Neal continue to talk hoops, Barkley revealed on the Dan Patrick Show on Wednesday he hasn't fully committed to making the move and remains in talks with other networks. "I haven't decided yet," Barkley admitted. "I'm listening to NBC and Amazon. I want to know everything that's on the table for me before I sign it. I love those guys at ESPN, and if we end up there, I'm going to do the best I possibly can. First of all, they haven't even given us any type of schedule whatsoever. But I'd be doing myself a disservice not to meet with NBC, which I have, and meet with Amazon, which I have. And the number one thing I've told everybody, can y'all give me a damn schedule?" Barkley said. Patrick, who previously worked for ESPN, told Barkley, "You're going to be working a lot more than you think you're going to be working," Barkley said, as he wouldn't be working like no damn dog and doesn't want to do ABC, ESPN, and TNT work. Currently, Barkley works 2 days a week for Inside the NBA, but he doesn't want to work more than that. "I wanted in writing how much we're going to be working," Barkley added. If Barkley opted to not be part of Inside the NBA when it moves to ESPN, it would be a massive blow, not just for the show or fans, but for ESPN, who is a big part of the allure to move the show to the network. In 2022, TNT announced new deals for all of the talent to make sure the team will remain together for many years to come. The New York Post reported Barkley's deal was for 10 years and estimated to be worth $100 million to $200 million. And that is all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Neil Kelly. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.